Monday, June 25th.
Glad you're keeping
2018.
You should clarify that there is no time crisis.
The show, LA Podcast.
I think people will be worried.
That there's going to be another time crisis? Well, we do have to go fast. We just don't, we won't use the format.
Okay.
We do have a lot of stuff this episode as well.
Right.
There's just no kitchen timer. I don't know where the kitchen timer is. The host, Scott Frazier, host, his Davenport. God, a few weeks ago on this program, we speculated that, you know, they're building these emergency shelters. There's $20 million allocated to build emergency shelters for people experiencing homelessness in L.A. And Scott and I speculated on this show that in exchange for neighborhoods building these shelters, there would be increased policing, sweeps of camps, stuff like that. Let's play a clip. Would that be?
That sounds good.
Cool.
Let's
initiate clip. I have heard chatter that in neighborhoods where the shelters go up, I've heard that the unspoken rule is going to be nobody is allowed to sleep on the street within a certain radius of that shelter. End clip.
Enhance.
Then this past a few days ago, on Friday, there was an article in the LA Times by Emily Alpert Reyes where the mayor, Eric Garcetti, is quoted as saying to the LA Times editorial board that indeed they are going to start increasingly arresting people that are on the street, basically making it illegal again to sleep on the sidewalk.
He called it he said essentially that it wasn't going to be the first option, but it's a tool that they have available.
A tool that they can and will use.
And will use, yeah.
Yes. This is so sleeping on the sidewalk in LA has technically been legal since about 2007. There was a ruling by a judge that said that it's okay to sleep on the sidewalk until the city builds something like 1,200 units of housing for people who are homeless.
And that still hasn't happened.
Well, it has, technically.
Oh, okay.
Percentage of them had to be downtown,
mm-hmm.
but in the last 11 years, they have managed to scrape together about 1,200 units.
Which is why this is now a tool that they're saying is, again,
that now it's legal
disposal.
Again. Saying nothing of the fact that the population of people who are homeless has exploded way out of proportion to the number of units that have been built.
Oh,
in the spirit of the rule, they haven't even come close to meeting the need.
It is, it's unconscionable, really, to think about, especially considering for the past several years, the language coming out of the mayor's office has entirely been one of essentially moral obligation to make sure that people are
everyone
housed.
In
yeah
every Let's
everyone
all
in.
Get in on this together.
But now so now this is a total essentially reversal and basically saying that there is going to be a push to resort to a hard line of enforcement in order to make sure that people are It's either use the shelters, whether or not they're available to you is an entirely separate question. Whether or not you want to be in a shelter is an entirely separate question, but use them or you're at the whim of a law enforcement officer if you're
you'll go to jail.
Person on the street. Yep.
Yes. I honestly thought this kind of language wouldn't come out until one of these shelters was up and running. Just when you think you're a little bit too cynical, you realize, oh, you're not even close to cynical enough. But what I think this is about is not really so, like, the most negative way to look at it is this message is to people who are homeless saying, like, don't come to the city or we'll throw you in jail. But who it's really to is the people who are loudest on this issue. Which is people who live in neighborhoods with homeless people who want them arrested or just like swept off the street. They just want them out of the neighborhood under any circumstances. That's who the mayor is talking to by saying that we will do sweeps. He's referred to sweeps in the past as a reward.
Yep.
For neighborhoods that bring in
that
shelters.
That allow housing units to be built.
Yes.
Right.
We'll clean out the camps. We'll get the homeless people off of the streets in your neighborhood. That is your little treat for allowing a shelter to go up.
For playing ball. So, I mean, it's I think even more cynical would be something that we've discussed in the past, where you have a mayor who's announced more or less that he's seeking higher office, while he is still the mayor, and
much higher office,
much higher office. So we talked before about, is it a problem if Garcetti is governing LA, but actually looking beyond the borders of the city and trying to, trying to think about what is an Iowa swing voter want to see from a chief executive, rather than what do people in LA need from him?
Yeah.
And I think now we're starting to see that that is a problem.
Yeah. And if he, you know, if you're thinking purely in terms of the numbers of homeless people in your city, you're thinking, okay, if we start arresting more of them, those people aren't on the books at the time of the next count. Yep. If you're in jail, you do not are not counted as a person who is homeless. And if some people, if a few more people don't show up from other cities, you know, most people who are homeless in LA come from LA, have lived here for 20 years, but some do come from other places. If we have a reputation for policing more, maybe fewer people will come, and that'll bring the number down even more. So if all he's doing is looking ahead to the next homeless count and thinking, oh, well, I just want it to be a little lower than it is this year.
Yep.
So I can say that's the most important count, because that's when he's going to be campaigning and saying, like, we, two consecutive years, we have brought the numbers of people who are homeless down. This that would help.
Yeah,
for that cause.
To continue in that vein, also we know that the most important thing for his incipient campaign for president is securing the large amounts of cash that are available in wealthy Hollywood enclaves.
Yep.
He's done a very good job so far at getting the interest of local wealthy people, so this is probably going to be fairly popular with them, as the problem of homelessness has spread beyond the traditional confines of downtown LA and is now, you know, we had the fire in the Sepulveda Pass last year and things like that, where now you have very rich people that are seeing, oh, there are homeless people in LA, something that's been apparent to everyone else for a long time. But this is probably a message that plays well with them too. So he's shoring up his funders. He's definitely making it so that he can possibly reduce the number of homeless people on the street by criminalizing them.
Yep.
You know, this all sounds extremely cynical, but this is a very cynical move. We already know, and Garcetti himself has said, criminalizing the homeless doesn't work. It's not a solution to the problem. And if everybody knows this, then what could be behind him doing this at this juncture? There are a lot of reasons. None of them are good.
No. And the upshot of what is happening in the city is, despite, like you were saying, all the rhetoric has been around, like, it's time to do something. This is an emergency. It's a humanitarian crisis. We have to do something right now. What has actually been happening practically is, as the numbers of people who are homeless in the city grow and grow and grow, the number of spaces that they are allowed to exist safely, comfortably, without fear of getting arrested, have been just gradually taken away. There's money out there for new housing, for shelters and things like that, but none of that is really come online yet, but lots of spaces have come offline. You can't sleep in your car anymore, as of last year, basically anywhere in LA. The last place left really is the sidewalk.
Which is, I mean, it's really despicable. I was personally very angry. I know a lot of other people were as well when the city council made it illegal to sleep in your car.
Yeah.
I see people sleeping in their cars every day on Sunset Boulevard in my neighborhood.
Yep.
Doing so for the most part illegally. And at this point, but they have nowhere else to go, nowhere else safe to go. The car allows them to get to their jobs, give some semblance of protection to their family. Oftentimes these are families sleeping in a car together. And it's now, as you said, we've gotten to a point where there is essentially no safe refuge for people that are unsheltered.
Nope.
And we're basically putting everybody at the whim of either an individual law enforcement officer, which is never a good thing to just say, if somebody doesn't like you or you talk the wrong way to somebody, they can seize your belongings and put you in jail. Or basically the loudest voices of NIMBYism in a given community. And so now, if you have no legal place to go, then everything that you do is illegal. Yes. And it all is dependent on your interactions, your personal interactions. You're at the whim of everyone.
Yeah. The only possible circumstance under which I could see criminalizing sidewalk sleeping, even this is a stretch, but if there were readily available housing to put people into, counseling and service programs, all kinds of alternatives, and even then, I think only during the day.
Yep.
Would be acceptable to say, like, you have to clean up your tent because the sidewalks should be accessible for people to walk on. Mm-hmm. That on those grounds alone, I think would it be half acceptable.
Yeah.
But under these circumstances, it's gross to even suggest it. It's a threat.
Yeah. It's absolutely a threat. And oof. And it definitely seems like I don't know. I think that the same reason why they struck this down in court the last time, essentially finding that the city had been delinquent in its responsibility to homeless people, is still the case now.
Yeah.
And it's hard to imagine them being able to actually enforce
that. That was interesting, right? Everyone, Mike Bonin, I think, said in a lot of the coverage of it, and tons of ACLU lawyers basically said, we dare you.
Yeah.
We dare you to try to do this. You will be sued into oblivion. The second you try. And he knows that. The mayor knows that.
Yeah.
Which means that it is a rhetorical device. It's not something that I don't think he really, that I think he really intends on doing, which is almost worse.
Yeah. Because it goes back to the issue of who is he talking to here.
Yep. Yep. Anyway, so as we've just been saying repeatedly, the loudest people on this issue in the mayor's ear are people calling him, asking for homeless people to be hosed off the street, basically. I'm guessing that the calls that his office receives are probably 95 to 5% in favor of criminalizing the homeless. If you want to call his office about this new policy that he announced on Friday, you can call 213-978-0600, 213-978-0600. Might be nice to move the needle in the opposite direction a little bit. These calls, if you've ever called your senator about anything, calls to the mayor's office mean much, much more. They don't get as many. So that is something you can do about this if you care. Anyway, we also want to, catch up on, we mentioned a neighborhood council election last week. To dedicate two segments to a neighborhood council election is just insane. But this one was so incredibly weird. There's a 4-block neighborhood in the Koreatown area called Little Bangladesh. They had submitted an application to essentially split the current Koreatown neighborhood council in half.
Right.
And something like, not quite, a little more than half would go to a new neighborhood council called like Wilshire Center, Little Bangladesh.
Yeah.
They got 500 signatures. They apply. That's the rule. And then it goes up for a vote. Other residents of Koreatown, specifically Korean residents, were very upset about this vote, mobilized to a completely unprecedented degree to stop this split from happening. There was a whole movement called Keep Koreatown, and they ended up getting 19,000 people when it's all said and done, maybe 20,000. The previous high, I think, was something like 3,000 for a neighborhood council election. Even that is crazy. Skid Row last year, the total was about 1,500 people.
Voting. Yeah, and the previous high was for the Westwood Forward district that the students put on the ballot. That was earlier this year.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, we're talking about a gulf of like 16,000 votes separating the first and the second most vote getting neighborhood council elections now.
And the reason, so the vote itself over this little Bangladesh neighborhood council is up for debate whether or not that was like a legitimate thing. Sure, Little Bangladesh is a very small neighborhood. That was a lot of territory that they were asking for. It's like a legitimate thing to say, like, that's too much.
I heard Grace Yu, K-Town booster and apparently the most readily available quote in the neighborhood.
Also very vocal about protesting the emergency shelter that's
going
up there.
Shelter.
It's worth mentioning.
She said that they were asking for something like 60% of the neighborhood. Was that true?
It was 60% of the current Koreatown neighborhood council, which does not cover all of Koreatown.
Right.
All this about, like, this will shrink Koreatown is a neighborhood that goes way beyond the neighborhood council district. Basically, the current district is too big.
Yeah.
There's too many people in it.
Right.
It should be subdivided. They just didn't want to call the new subdivision Little Bangladesh.
Okay.
And there was concern that after Little Bangladesh actually did get its own designated neighborhood last year, that they would be able to expand it with the support of this neighborhood council.
So Grace, you had said her language was very much in keeping with the Keep Koreatown video that we watched last week, where she was saying, you know, they are trying to take over Koreatown or whatever.
Yeah.
I think it's funny to note that Grace Yu also has run for city council in the past. She ran against Herb Wesson, who represents District 10.
I'm going to make an outside prediction that she will run again.
She probably will run again. It's a shame that all the people who mobilized for the neighborhood council election did not turn out for Grace Yu, who got 4,000 votes in the council district.
Wow. Well, here's the reason why is because in a neighborhood council election, you don't have to actually live in the neighborhood. You just have to have a community interest, which, as we said last week, you can have two receipts that from a business in the neighborhood that constitutes community interest. People came in from Cerritos, San Bernardino County. One could say that if you do not live or work in the same county as a neighborhood, that you should not be allowed to vote in one of these elections, but whatever. The thing that to me that is interesting and genuinely scary is a lot of the rhetoric after the fact. Mm. There's a lot of legitimate grievance in Koreatown about how the 92 riots were handled. It was essentially left to burn.
Yep.
In the 92 riots, the cops didn't show up for 3 days. It was a really bad situation. I think this seems to have cultivated an environment there where they feel like they're always on the defensive.
Yeah.
And lots of the rhetoric I saw on the Facebook page afterwards, someone said after they won by 18,800 votes, someone said, "This was crucial. It showed not only the Bangladesh community, but also the city council to tread lightly when you're dealing with K-Town." The official page said, "This is not over. We will continue to fight to make sure Koreatown is not treated like this again." There's this language.
Yeah, it's very combative. And on a certain level, I think that it's rooted in a place that makes some sense to me. Because, I mean, for instance, the city council has historically been afraid of this voting bloc of Koreans. And you can see that in the way that the council district lines have been drawn and redrawn to continually fragment K-Town as a
council district 4, which includes K-Town, is the most fucked
and CD
design.
Yeah so you got CD4,
it's
which is
bizarre worm that takes a little slice of Koreatown but is not supposed to be enough to actually constitute a huge voting block for them. That's that still the last election a Korean American person was elected and
for the first time in the history of the city have a Korean American representing one of the city council districts. So I think it's represented by 3 districts currently.
Yeah.
You got 4, 10, and 1, I want to say.
Mm-hmm.
But I get the sense that that there are, you know, outside forces that are seeking to dilute the large. We should say that even though Koreans make up 30% of the Koreatown district, that is by far the densest neighborhood in all of Southern California. So 30% of the neighborhood.
It's a lot of people.
It's like 40 or so, maybe 50,000 people.
Yeah.
It's a lot of people. It's a considerable voting block if properly organized. So I get the activist sense that there's power in numbers and they can do more to protect their own interests. That said, the rhetoric is definitely when you're not talking about an entrenched power, you're talking about a 4-block strip of for the most part incredibly impoverished minority migrant communities.
Yes.
In the Little Bangladesh
that overextended in terms of what they wanted to expand their brand of Little Bangladesh, and Koreatown made a really, really outsized effort to crush them, and it was a very racially charged movement. And it is the result of the city having marginalized this group because of their race for years and years and years. And now they've created this force that feels like they have to defend themselves at all times. And it manifests itself in really ugly ways. The protests about the shelter are even much worse than what happened with Keep Koreatown.
And that's still going on.
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh my God, you have all this content and now we have a guest to introduce. So, I mean, it's free. Incredible. we have Jason McGann, who's a freelance journalist. He was doing, he's been writing a few articles lately for Capital in Maine, which is a great California publication, about the homelessness crisis in LA. Specifically for Jason, he's been writing about the lack of bathrooms on Skid Row for public places to use the bathroom and places, centers of homelessness in LA. This is a great series. This was our first, by the way, time a PR person reached out to us to see if we wanted to cover something, which is what you do for a legitimate news organization. So that is what we are now, officially.
It's official.
Yes. They reached out and said, hey, we're doing this series. It's great. There are a bunch of great... Gustavo Arellano, who seems to write like two pieces a day in like every publication you can publish in. He's incredibly prolific. He has a piece in it that's good. The whole series is great. So if you just Google Capital in Maine, homelessness, Los Angeles, you'll find it. But it's really good stuff. And Jason McGann joined us to talk about the reporting he's been doing on bathrooms on Skid Row. Welcome, Jason McGann. Can we just get a little rundown? Like, currently, what's the situation in Skid Row? How many public bathrooms are there for how many people? Just what's the current situation?
Well, for the over 2,000 people estimated to be sleeping at night on Skid Row, there are approximately 5 to 6 automated self-cleaning public toilets available to them overnight. And recently, there were somewhere in the neighborhood, I believe, 9 toilets that were opened in one of the shelters recently with round-the-clock security for 24 hours. So I guess that gets us up to about 14 or 15 toilets available 24 hours a day to the homeless population sleeping outside of the shelters at night. Now, that number increases during the day when you factor in the porta potties that are available in the parks, which are shuttered at around dusk. As well as the facilities that are available inside the different shelters. So, I mean, that number increases, but by any standard, it's really lacking for the need.
Those porta johns in the parks, is there security around those as well, or those are not policed at all?
They have a security service. I saw them in action, a couple of guys sitting in their car parked against the curb. They don't really get out of their car too much, but their job is to kind of keep an eye on the toilets. It depends on who you talk to and how thoroughly they perform that. But there's also this new nonprofit that was brought in, which has these attendants, most of whom are formerly incarcerated people who've experienced homelessness at some point in their lives in some cases. And they have these fluorescent vests on, and they sit next to a cart with cleaning supplies on them next to the automated toilets on the street. And, they give a courtesy knock after 7 minutes. They make sure that, it's one person at a time. And they're not security. They're not charged with providing security. But I think their presence there has done a lot more than other attempts to try to create a safe and clean environment.
Is that Lava May? Is that that nonprofit, or is it a different one?
Lava May is also a nonprofit that provides bathroom services and showers out of a portable trailer that is regularly parked on a daily basis in Skid Row. And that's been going on for a few years now. And that has been a definite success story. But again, when we factor in the scale of the problem, there needs to be more of that.
Right. You're talking about, based on what you said, one bathroom for every couple hundred residents of Skid Row, basically. So obviously the need is really great. When you were actually in Skid Row reporting for your piece, are there lines? What is the situation? How is personal hygiene being managed? Obviously a lot of the time it's just resulting in urination and defecation on the street. But what did you see while you were out there?
it's pretty surreal. There are lines, particularly during, you know, the busy parts of the day at some of these automated toilets, you know, and some lines even in the parks to use them. But I think, you know, more than anything is just, you know, what you said before, that people who, you know, for a host of reasons choose to do other than wait in line for the bathroom or use the bathroom. Those bathrooms don't lock. They have had a lot of problems with maintenance. Some of them are in terrible shape in terms of just basic sanitation inside.
And you mentioned in your piece that, that safety is an issue. People don't feel safe in those bathrooms. What are they worried about happening?
Well, talking to a number of homeless folks who've been in Skid Row for a number of years, as well as employees at different shelters and advocates who work with the population. I mean, everybody says that periodically there have been problems with people, sort of a criminal element, seizing control of bathroom access and using them for prostitution purposes, or, you know, also that people who want some privacy while they use drugs prefer those bathrooms and tend to kind of, you know, commandeer them for long periods of time, therefore making them inaccessible. So, I mean, that is an issue and something that, you know, I think that everybody is kind of has grappled with in different ways, some constructive and some kind of erring more on the criminalizing side that doesn't really even begin to address the basic need for a place to use the bathroom. So
what has been keeping bathrooms out of this neighborhood? Is it a money issue? Like, what's stopping it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's where you look at the issue of bathroom access as part of the larger problem of homelessness in downtown in Los Angeles. I mean, you know, you have a situation where you have, you know, more than 2,000 people sleeping out on the street without these services. You know, when you get into the question of why, I mean, I think that you run into this kind of age-old conflict going back decades around homelessness in Los Angeles, which is, you know, concerns stemming from land development and land value versus concerns about providing, you know, sort of humanitarian services to this increasing number of people that are being forced to sleep out on the street. And so I think that, you know, if you look around downtown and what's happening and the construction boom and the increase in property values, you know, you see plenty of examples of folks, you know, playing the waiting game, property owners, business owners, awaiting this eventual ability to develop some parts of Skid Row, and which sits right in the middle of a number of prosperous areas of downtown. Right. There was a, you know, a piece that just came out at the LA Times a couple days ago, which shows that this downtown LA 2040 plan, which the city has been working on with the planning department for quite some time, this draft proposal confirms what a lot of advocates have been warning about for a long time, which is that you know, three main streets that go east to west through Skid Row, 5th, 6th, and 7th Streets. Under this current form of the proposal, would be opened up to market rate residential development, also these kind of creative spaces, work, you know, workspaces and things of that nature. And, you know, so this is something that really brings to a head this conflict. I mean, the question, when I raised it to a longtime homeless advocate, Eddie H. in Skid Row, who's has been working for decades in that area, he said that the way that he and his fellow advocates see it is basically an issue of erasure versus non-erasure. He says that they've been working on it for so long and having such difficulty getting agreement on such basic issues that basically the way they see it is that they're being deliberately ignored, because if there's a sense from those opposed to bathrooms that if you were to install these kinds of basic services, that you would be essentially allowing this population to perhaps feel more comfortable, therefore congregate in greater numbers. Therefore, I mean, you can sort of,
you can
draw your own conclusions.
Logic all the way down. Yeah. I totally agree about the concept of it being a matter of erasure. I think when you look at the composition of a population of unhoused people, such as LA's, it really reads, at least to me, like the groups of people that have been more or less abandoned by the policies that exist. I mean, that's why we have the overrepresentation of people with substance abuse, survivors of domestic violence, Black people, trans people. You know, that's something that we can definitely see by looking just at the composition of the group itself. But at the same time, what you said, I think, is also true. You have this notion among people that are more empowered that they don't want to do anything that's going to entrench the population in Skid Row, which, I mean, obviously, we know it's not necessarily going anywhere anyway. But how do people encourage elected officials to overcome that sort of resistance and actually provide? I mean, this is the UN called it a humanitarian crisis. This is something that can't be allowed to continue, even if it potentially is going to make people more money to not put bathrooms in place. There needs to be hygiene available to people readily, right? So how does the average Angeleno help that happen?
Well, I mean, that's the question. And I think going back to the Refresh Bot, which we discussed, opened on December 4th last year, that was sort of a modest initial step to begin to address the issue. And it's been an unmitigated failure. I mean, it opened 4 months after it opened, it closed. It was supposedly a 30-day closure while new trailers were rotated in. It was called an expansion. Most recently, I heard possibly midsummer reopening. That's not certain. I've been told by sources close to the issue that, you know, there are issues relating to bureaucratic concerns, whether the trailers have wheels or don't have wheels, puts them in different categories. There's more red tape. Whatever the reason may be, you know, this thing was open to great fanfare. Homeless people were told about it, that it was something that would be made available to them. And I can't tell you how many people I talked to who are living on the streets of Skid Row who use that as exhibit A of how, you know, every time something appears to represent a step forward, they view it with incredible skepticism because now it's gone and it's almost as though it never existed.
Are there other theories for why those trailers were taken away and haven't come back? I mean, is it real? I mean, they were there, like it was set up. Is it just a red tape issue? Or
I heard from General Dogan, and this is not confirmed from the city, but he told me that that the process for opening the Refresh Spot was set up and timed to coincide with the 1 year anniversary of the voter passage of Measure HHH in the city. And that sort of political or public relations optical priority basically overrode other considerations like how long can we keep the trailers? Do we own the trailers? Are these trailers something that will remain on that spot for an extended period? And so once that press conference was had and the news was written, a few months later, it's gone, and there's differing explanations as to why, but the fact of the matter is that, you know, the issue persists, and there's no restrooms, there's no hand washing stations. I mean, there are, but they're very limited.
From your perspective, and in the investigation that you've done, has there been any, are there any elected officials that are individually making a push to address this issue, or does it seem like it's kind of just mired in, you know, kind of just inaction right now?
I mean, I think that the closest thing to, a vision coming from any elected officials is this idea of coexistence of these differing priorities. And so there's this, I mean, this idea I mentioned earlier, these east-west corridors on 5th, 6th, and 7th Street are, you know, the proposals that they'll be opened up to mixed-use market-rate development, but then the north-south streets going through the same part of Skid Row will remain available to social services. I mean, that's sort of an example of this kind of attempt at balance, which, you know, a lot of these advocates have serious misgivings about. Once you know, these major corridors are opened up to private development, and that begins to dramatically increase the value of the land and the prospects for people investing in it, that, you know, what's going to happen to the largest concentration of homeless people in the United States? And, you know, it's a complicated issue, and I don't think anybody that has ever been through Skid Row on foot or in a car is proud of that part of the city when they see what's there. It's terrible to that it exists, but at the same time, you know, if you begin to address it through, you know, through this way, I think there's a valid concern that perhaps what you're ultimately doing is dispersing the problem elsewhere and sort of kicking the can down the road.
Because it's not just Skid Row, right, where this conflict is happening. There's a big fight in Venice as well. To my knowledge, I think council member Mike Bonin has been trying to get bathrooms and some kind of hygiene situation off the ground in Venice to huge pushback. Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel that feels like it's even louder than what's been going on in Skid Row. I mean, is there any progress on that front that you know of?
Right. I mean, I think, you know, there's Venice is getting a lot of attention right now. There's a similar dynamic taking place in Koreatown. Less covered have been similar conflicts in Hollywood, Echo Park. The list goes on. And yes, I mean, I think that the city is making a deliberate push towards a decentralization of homeless services, and so, you know, each council district takes on a certain portion of emergency shelters, long-term supportive permanent housing, what have you. And what you're seeing in these other neighborhoods is this NIMBYism, which, you know, was in Orange County, now it's in Venice, and you have folks who are objecting to, you know, the number of beds that are being proposed for their areas, people who are opposing to any beds whatsoever. You know, and I think that part of the reason why I wanted to focus this particular investigation on Skid Row is because historically in Skid Row, that's been the area of the city designated for homeless services to be provided, with the expectation that a number of homeless people would live there in low-income arrangements, SROs, whether it be permanent supportive housing, what have you. And, you know, if there's any part of Los Angeles that culturally is acclimated to large numbers of very low-income people, recently homeless, living there, it would be Skid Row.
So, I mean, this is dating back to the, like, 20s and 30s, right? I mean, like, it was originally, like you're saying, it was originally designed for the purpose of, like, low-income, like, laborers and, like, people sort of down on their luck,
like,
living.
Like a legacy of prohibition.
Yeah.
Right, and many cities in the United States had this almost like a quarantine area for homeless people, but Los Angeles is one of the few that maintain that policy. And so there's, you know, most if not all of the shelters and missions in Los Angeles are concentrated there. People know if they're experiencing homelessness that if you go there, anything from you can receive anything from job training to food to shelter and so forth. And you know, I think that's it's been controversial, but I mean it is a resource. And so the question is moving forward, you know, to what degree is the city going to be able to reach these homeless people where they are, and to what degree will it be successful in being able to kind of decentralize these services and get these different areas that we're talking about of the city to begin to, you know, accept a similar type of arrangement.
Yeah, because in the last couple years, there was a major hepatitis A outbreak in the homeless population in L.A. and Orange County. We hear statistics like I think the life expectancy in Skid Row is 46 or something like that. You mentioned in your article Reverend Andy Bales, who directs the Union Rescue Mission. He's been infected with how many different three different kinds of like flesh-eating bacteria, lost his leg from that. Are people drawing the lines between the lack of hygiene in this neighborhood and all these different like health crises? It seems like they would be pretty strongly related.
Well, I think LA dodged a major bullet last year with when that hepatitis outbreak happened throughout Southern California, particularly the worst was in San Diego. There were cases recorded in the city. But I think that, you know, in reporting this story, I had an opportunity to walk around Skid Row on a couple occasions with health workers, trained health workers, and had this discussion, not on the record, unfortunately, because of their conflict there, but just talking, and there's a real concern from health workers in that part of downtown about the potential health the health consequences to the continued lack of bathroom access in Skid Row. There are a whole host of bacteria that are believed to be able to prosper under those kind of conditions. And Andy Bales, you mentioned, lost his leg while working out on Skid Row. There's the number of homeless people who died last year increased pretty significantly from previous years. And in talking with Andy Bales, he attributes part of that increase to this very issue of feces and urine being allowed to be on the streets and it's spreading into the air and so forth. So it's a major health concern, and in the short term, I think that's the real issue here.
Yeah, even if you're the most cynical, selfish NIMBY, and you want to keep this problem quarantined to Skid Row, I mean, you're walking through this stuff on the street, it's on your shoes. It can spread really easily. This is a hugely dangerous potential problem. It feels like, but I don't know. I don't feel that kind of sense of urgency surrounding it.
Well, I think you also have to keep in mind that part of the reason why LA is an outlier in how we handle the situation with the volume of homeless people that we actually have here is that Skid Row, the NIMBYs that you're talking about, have been able to conceive of homelessness as something that totally has no interaction with their lives at all. It was just, these services can remain in a part of the city where nobody will ever go. And so therefore it is both invisible and sadly irrelevant to many of the people that live here. That's starting to change now, obviously. As Jason was saying, now there's a huge amount of money here, and the money doesn't easily coexist with the enormous need on Skid Row. So hopefully the greater visibility leads to some pressure to change, but I don't know that we're necessarily seeing that with the urgency that it probably demands right now.
So what's coming up? What's next? Are there any plans for, you said the refresh spot in Skid Row might come back in the summer. Is there any money being allocated for more resources? Is any money coming out of Measure HH, or Measure H, I guess, would be the one that includes services. Is there any potential for more bathrooms coming in the next year?
Well, the missions are stepping up. There's Union Rescue is about to install, I believe it's 16 toilets on land on the mission's property, which will be available 24 hours with security on the model of Midnight Mission. And that's one thing. And presumably the refresh spot will reopen at some point. Lava May will continue to provide its chiller during the day. And the city of LA recently passed a budget measure to install permanent toilets in the parks, which will help during daytime hours. But as I mentioned earlier, those parks are shuttered at night. And so those toilets will continue to be unavailable to people living out, forced to sleep out on the streets in Skid Row at night. And so, I think that the missions, to the degree that anybody is stepping in the short term, providing immediate solutions to the problem, it would be the missions that are doing so. The city doesn't, hasn't put anything forward that I would say is differs fundamentally from the status quo.
That's it. Thank you for listening.
That was a really great interview, by the way, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very informative.
Yeah. He was awesome. By the way, Jason, former LA Weekly staff writer before the bad times.
The purge.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you, Jason, for coming on the show.
And thank you, everyone, for listening to the show. And we will see you next week on LA Podcast.